I never gave a perfect speech. And if I gave one, I wouldn't know what it was. There's always some question. And last time after my speech, the question was, well, you criticized the mainstream from an Austrian point of view. Is there anything you agree with the mainstream? The way I made it sound is if they were all wrong on everything and we were all right on everything. I think we are all right on everything, except for some internecine debates. But there's a Venn diagram. And the Venn diagram is an overlapping circles, which shows that there are areas of agreement. This would be the Austrian part that they don't agree with. This would be the Chicagoan part where, or the mainstream or the neoclassical where we don't agree. But this area, and I don't mean it to be that small, just that it's an overlap, is areas where we agree. For example, most economists think that free trade is good, efficient to be non-normative. Most economists think that the minimum wage law will unemploy unskilled workers. Most think that rent control is a problem. Most think that excessive government regulation is problematic. So there are vast areas of agreement. And I would say that of all the disciplines, feminist studies, black studies, queer studies, sociology, history, whatever, there's the most agreement in economics, namely economics as a profession is the most free enterprise of all the disciplines. Now, today my subject is Ronald Coase. Thanks. I paid him $5 to boo every time I say Coase, but and I would say the same thing applies here. I don't disagree with everything Coase ever did. Coase won a Nobel Prize. He must have done something right. And as a matter of fact, here are some areas. Let me get this straight. Where we agree. I mentioned two books where we... can you see that now? The first book is The Federal Communications Commission, where he was criticizing the Federal Communications Commission for violating free speech, the First Amendment. Now, I thought he was pretty good. He did this, the market for goods and the market for ideas, namely sort of a John Stuart Mill on liberty thing that we should have a market for ideas. We should have a free market in ideas. If we favor a free market in goods and services, we should also allow ideas to have free reign. So I thought that was pretty good. Then on the bad side, I disagree with the problem of social cost and the lighthouse in economics. And I'm going to go over both of them and try to say why I disagree. Before I do, let me first say that the problem of social cost, which I'll start, is the most widely cited article in all of economics. And people, in order to get tenure, you have to publish. But in addition to publishing, what you should do is get other people to cite your stuff. So if you graduate with, or you have five or six classmates, what you have to do is promise to cite each other's stuff because self-citations don't count. So Coase is the most, this article of Coase is the most widely cited article in all of economics, which is an honor. It shows that people pay attention to what he's saying. I think it's wrong and tragically wrong and mischievously wrong. And really an abomination. And I would say that he's worse than the commies, because at least the commies had a theory of property rights, namely the bourgeois don't have any and the proletariat has. But it, I mean, it's not a good theory, but it's a theory. Whereas his theory, as I'll try to show, is doesn't even deserve the name theory. It's just a horror. Okay, so what's going on? What's going on is if there's a dispute over property rights between two people, and the court has to decide who gets it, and Coase has some suggestions for the court as to how to decide. Before I give the Coasean view, let me give the libertarian view, not the Austrian view, because the Austrian view has, Austrianism or Austrian economics has no view on justifications of property rights or justice in property rights, because Austrian economics is a positive science. Value-free. It just says what causes what or how do we explain and understand economic reality. It doesn't say what justice consists of. That's libertarian. But this sort of issue straddles the gap between normative and positive, as you'll see. Okay, so what's the libertarian view? Suppose I have a dispute with Dr. Don Prince, and I say I own the wallet that's in his pocket, And he says he owns the wallet that's in his pocket. And the judge looks in the wallet and sees a picture of his wife and his five daughters, and there's a bill of sale for the thing, and it's got pictures of him holding the wallet proudly. And the judge says, well, why do you think you own it? I said, well, I like it. You know, either the judge laughs or he throws me in jail for frivolous lawsuits. And I think that's just because libertarians look at private property rights for virgin territory as being based on homesteading. You mix your labor with the land, John Locke says, Murray Rothbard says, Hans Hoppe said, you own the land. There are all sorts of problems like how intensively do you have to farm, for how long do you have to farm, but I'm going to sweep those aside. But the basic element is you own virgin territory that you mix your labor with, because you have a better claim on it than some guy who comes along second and wants it, because you've already been acting on it. And then the other justifications for property rights are any voluntary interaction thereafter. So if I homestead corn and you domesticate a cow, and you own the milk and now I own the corn, and we trade, and now I have milk that I didn't produce, but I can trace it back to a voluntary trade, and you now have what I produced, the corn, even though you didn't produce it, you were milking cows. So justice, legitimacy, and property titles is based on homesteading and any voluntary interaction thereafter, such as trade, gifts, gambling, whatever, anything voluntary, anything peaceful. What does Coase say about this? Coase says something very different about this. Coase doesn't say, well, Dr. Don Prince got it in a legitimate way and he homesteaded, maybe he made the leather in the wallet. He asks, he doesn't look at the past. Namely, we are looking in the past. We're turning back the clock to determine justice and property rights. What happened before will determine justice and property rights. Coase doesn't look at it that way. He looks at it, what will happen from now on is the determination of legitimacy and property rights. Although he doesn't use the word legitimacy, what he's after is maximizing GDP. Now, it just happens that Don Prince is a bum. And what he's going to do with that wallet is spend some of the money on swill and get drunk. And he's going to go visit prostitutes and he's going to buy pornography. I hope you don't mind me picking on you like this, Don. Whereas I, wonderful person, I'm going to use that money to do great things. I'll invent the wheel or whatever I'll invent. I'll do great things. If I have the money, the GDP will rise. If he's got the money, the GDP will be just sort of wasted. Guess who Coase is going to give the wallet to? It's amazing. It's appalling. I'm glad you're all sitting down for this, because if you weren't, you'd keel right over. Coase will award his wallet to me, which is, you know, totally ridiculous. Well, it's got a certain low cunning, because the GDP will rise. But, you know, the next day, he has all sorts of debates between, the cows that are straying onto the cornfields, and who should put up the fence, and who should stop, you know. And it depends upon the relative prices of meat and corn. So one day, the cows are more valuable, so the corn has to give way, the corn owner, and the next day it's the opposite way, namely relative prices change, and all of a sudden property titles change. So they keep changing with relative prices, or with the estimation of a judge as to who's going to make better use of the law. I have a numerical example to give you. I have a situation where Lou Rockwell and I both claim ownership of the Mises Institute. Now, the fact of the matter is that he's been the president forever. I think it started in 1980 or something like that. And I've been an employee every once in a while, maybe two or three times a year. But he, in any sense of justice, he mixed his labor with it. He created it. He organized it. And yet, before the fact, I should cover this up for a second, I value... What happened? Why isn't it? Oh, I see what's happening. There we go. I value the Mises Institute at $50 million or $50 for simplicity. He values it at 10. Where did I get this? I made it up. Just like Coase. Coase makes things up like this too. So if he does it, I should do it, because I'm entitled to engage in a reductio ad absurdum, namely take the logic of what he's doing and apply it to different cases. Okay, so I value it at 50, he values it at 10, even though he created it, but creating it is in the past. I can make much better use of it. I can turn it into a gambling establishment, and I'll make a lot of money, and He'll just have these crappy conferences and he won't make as much money. So the GDP will rise if I get to own it. That's the background. Now, the court can have, here is Coase's contribution on the basis of which he earned the Nobel Prize. I think it was mainly this sort of stuff. What he says is that in the zero transactions cost world, there are two states of the world. In the zero transaction, I should start at the beginning. What are transactions cost? I bought this tie. I had to go to the store. I had to find the store. That's a cost of making the transaction. Maybe had a contract, and maybe there's a lawyer involved if it's a big shipment of ties. These are transactions costs. Finding each other, ensuring that the deal goes through, ensuring the policy that if it falls apart, they'll return it. Those are all transactions costs. And it's true that transactions costs are an important part of costs. It's not just land, labor, and capital. It's also transactions. Fine. So in a world, in a never, never imaginary world of zero transactions costs, there's no such thing as zero costs of anything, Coase says it doesn't matter what the judge says. The same person will end up owning the resource, namely resources will be allocated in the same way no matter what the judge says. So I value it at $50 and Lou values it at $10. And in the first iteration, what happens is that Lou wins. Lou wins the Mises Institute. Now, I value it at $50. He only values it at $10. So what I do is I say, Lou, hey, look, you only value it at $10. I value it at $50. I'll give you $35 for it. And Lou says, well, if I have $35 on the plus side and I'll lose the $10 value that I place on the Mises Institute, everyone following this, I'll end up with $25. And $25 is more than $10, and we're trying to maximize revenue, so Lou will accept my bribe. I also will profit because right now Lou won the Mises Institute. I lost it, so I valued at $50. It only cost me a $35 bribe. I had to pick some number between 10 and 50. I picked 35 just for illustration purposes. And I make a profit of 15. So even if the judge awards it to Lou, I get it, right? I can bribe him out of it because I value it much more than him. Even at this stage, my first article, which came out in the early 70s, I said, well, this assumes that I've got the money with which to pay the bribe. Suppose I don't have it. Suppose my valuation of the Mises Institute is just purely psychic. Namely, I would pay 50 if I had it, and I wouldn't sell it for less than 50 if I owned it, but I haven't got one dime to scratch against the other. So where am I going to get this $35 to buy? So I said, he's even wrong on that, that very basic element. And then this guy, Harold Demsetz, semi-famous economist, I wrote an article saying what I just said, that Coase is wrong even on this level. Harold Demsetz lit into me. I was just a graduate student. I think maybe I had my PhD 1 year. It was before I got my PhD. It was like my second or third publication, I forget. He really lit into me. This moron block doesn't know his one part of his body from another part of his body. This is all wrong. And over the years, we had like a 5 back and forth articles on this. And I was very honored to have a debate with a very famous economist. So I think I'm right on that. I think that even on this level, it's by no means clear that I'll have the 35 with which to make the bribe. But let's forget about that and go on to more mistakes. Now, suppose we have the second after case, and here I win. The judge says, okay, Block, you win. I valued at 50, so I'll keep my 50. Lou will have nothing because he doesn't get the Mises Institute. Will he have enough money to bribe me out of it? No. Because he only values it at 10, and I'm not going to sell it for less than 50. So there's no bribe, and I keep the Mises Institute either way. Whichever way the judge rules, I keep it. In one case, I have to make a bribe, so I'm poorer. In the other case, I don't have to make a bribe. That's true. But the bottom line for Coase is resource allocation, and I get to keep it no matter what the judge says. Okay, that's the zero transactions cost world, which is, admittedly, Coase admits this, it's not really the real world. And now let's get to the real world, which is much more important. So now Coase says, well, in the real world, who should the judge award the Mises Institute to? Or who should the judge award the wallet now sitting in Dawn's pocket. I say it that way to not prejudge that it's his. It's just a wallet sitting in his pocket. What should the judge do in the real world? He should give it to the person who values it more. And if I value Dawn's wallet more, or if I value the Mises Institute more, I get it. Because in the real world, if you give it to the wrong guy, he can't make the bribe because transactions cost it much higher than any of these costs. So whatever the judge says sticks, and therefore the judge should decide in a way that will maximize GDP, namely give it to the person who values it the most. Let me give you a real world case of Coase. These are reductio ad absurdum. I'm taking the Coasean logic and I'm applying it to cases that he never applied it to. Now I'm going to apply it to a case where Coase did actually give in his article. And here are two guys. There's a doc, a doctor, and a machinist. And they each have a house that touches, the two houses touch each other. And what happened was that the doctor had his office there first. I'm putting a one there to show the time dimension. He first had his office, and he needs very, very quiet because he pokes a stethoscope at people's chests and he wants to hear what's going on and needs absolute quiet, which is fine because the machine was here also at time one, and the machine makes noise, and I'll indicate noise by those little dots, okay? And everything is fine. The doctor can't hear the machine. The machine is way at the other end of the house. Then what happens is that the machinist moves his machine over here and now makes noise into the doctor's area. How would the libertarian solve this? He would give the nod to the doctor because the doctor was there first. He homesteaded quiet. This guy is a Johnny-come-lately. He moved the doctor was all set up with his office and stethoscope and everything, and now this guy starts making noise, and he homesteaded quiet. Would be the way I think the libertarian would analyze that. How does the Coase analyze this? He says, well, in a zero transaction cost, it wouldn't matter. Okay, assuming that the one who has to make the bribe has enough money with which to make the bribe, fine. Then he asks, well, who values it more? He doesn't look in the past. He says, well, how do we maximize GDP? How much does it cost to move this? How much would it cost to move the doctor's office over here? And whichever cost is cheaper, that's the way he'll judge. And what I say is that this is horrendous. This is preposterous. I'm now going to give a case, and I hope it doesn't offend anyone. I don't mean it to offend anyone, but I'm going to give it because I think it's a very dramatic way of making the case. I rape a woman, and I'm called before the Coasean judge. I now have a defense, other than I didn't do it and I have an alibi, I was somewhere else. I say, sure, I did it. But I was away at sea for 6 months and I really needed her services. And she is a loose woman and she wouldn't mind that much. And I will gain $10,000 out of this rape and she'll only lose $100 out of it. The Coasean judge will let me go free. Is that preposterous? Now, the criticism of me is, well, Coase never talked about rape. I don't care. I'm just using his logic to show the logical implications of what he says. See, in the this is Sturgis versus Bridgman, the case, I forget who was the doctor and who was the machinist. It doesn't sound too bad. But with rape, it sounds very bad. Then there's the case of O.J. Simpson. Remember him? He allegedly killed his wife. And there were two schools of thought. He killed her, he should go to jail. He didn't kill her, he should go free. Thanks to Coase, we have a third option. He killed her and he should go free. Why? Because in the zero transactions cost world, he would have bought her in the voluntary slave market because she has low self-esteem and he's very rich, so he would have owned her. And if he owns her, he has a right to kill her. QED. I got this stuff published in law reviews. To the great embarrassment and humiliation of Coase and the Coaseans. And the Coaseans are legion. Talk about a cult. Tom Woods talked about the cult of non-Rothbard. There's a cult of Coase. Coase is revered. He walks on water. No, he trots on water. He runs on water. I mean, he's a great guy. But this is highly problematic, to say the least. Okay, that's about it for this. I just want to look at my notes to make sure that I said everything I wanted to say. Sometimes I forget the good stuff. I'll probably forget the good stuff this time anyway, because I never give perfect speeches or even really good ones, but I do my best. Okay, so now what's going on? We're now going to go to the second article of Coates, The Lighthouse. This is maybe not the most famous article, like the social cost one. This isn't quoted the most of all economics articles, but this is up there. I mean, he's a Nobel Prize winner, and of all the Nobel Prize winners, he's probably more famous within the profession than pretty much anyone else, with the possible exception of Friedman. I'm not sure about that. But Coase is a very important person in economics, and Coase has had a free ride, and I think we have to jump on him. Okay, so the way I'll introduce The Lighthouse is with this thing called public goods. Now, in my previous lecture, I said that what the mainstream mainly specializes in is market failures. They love market failures. And I went over the market failure of monopoly. I went over the market failure of external economies or externality, positive externalities. And then I went over the market failure, so-called, of negative externalities or external diseconomies. With the monopoly, just review a little bit, because I think it's important that we criticize this idea of market failure. The way the mainstream sees it is if we have monopoly or competition, it depends upon how many competitors there are. So they're forever taking 4-firm concentration ratios or 8-firm concentration ratios, or this thing called the Herfindahl Index. Raise your hand if you've heard of the Herfindahl Index. Oh, wow. Okay. Wow. I realize where I'm at now. A 4-firm concentration ratio is easier than the Herfindahl Index. It's what percentage of either sales or profits or employment or something do the top 4 firms in an industry account for? So if the top 4 firms in the industry each have 20% for a total of 80, and then there's a whole bunch of other guys that account for the other 20%, the 4-firm ratio is 80%. And this is very bad. This would trigger an antitrust case. Whereas the Austrians, the way we see it, it doesn't, you don't count numbers, you don't count noses, because it's very arbitrary. What is the industry? Is it cars? Or is it cars plus trucks or SUVs? Or how about motorcycles? Or how about the fact that when people think of buying a car, they might also think of buying a sailboat or a piano or a whole room full of furniture for roughly the same expenditures? It's very arbitrary what the industry is. Is it breakfast cereals? Is it all breakfast food? Is it the breakfast and lunch food? I mean, the more widely you define the thing, the lower you'll get the concentration ratio. I mean, in breakfast cereals, it's pretty high. But in all food, the concentration ratio is very low. So the defense argues for a wide definition of the industry, and the plaintiff, the government usually, although there are private plaintiffs, argues for a very narrow definition so they can get a high concentration ratio. And what's right? Well, it's just silly. I mean, the whole thing is silly. Whereas for the Austrians, the key is their legal entry. If you can compete without going to jail, it's competitive, and if not, not. The New York Times is the... Well, let me take the Times-Picayune in New Orleans. It's the only newspaper, the only daily newspaper in New Orleans. And according to those guys, it would be a monopoly. And if the administration didn't like their editorial policy, they might launch a lawsuit against them for that reason. But it's perfectly legal to go into competition with them. Anyone can set up another newspaper in New Orleans and try to sell it, and they don't go to jail. On the other hand, there are many, many taxis in New Orleans, many of them, but it's illegal for you to enter. If you enter without a medallion or a license, you go to jail. So it's a monopoly, even though there are a lot of people in there. So for the Austrians, monopoly has got nothing to do with counting noses. It's got to do with, you know, freedom. And traditionally, what a monopoly was in England, if the Duke of London fought the good fight against the French, he gets the candle monopoly. And that means anyone else makes candles without paying this guy off, go goes to jail or gets beheaded or whatever. And that's what a monopoly is, not this single seller. Even potential competition. There could just be one railroad. There was one railroad, I think, in one of the muckraking novels in California, and they were acting very arbitrarily and capriciously. They promised that this would be the fair for corn or something, and then when the corn came there, they tripled it. My question is, why didn't somebody else set up a railroad parallel to it, you know, 10 miles away? And the answer was, because you had to get the permission of the California Assembly, and the railroad had those guys in their pockets. So even potential competition, if there was only one railroad and there was none of this prohibition, legal prohibition of setting up a competition, they couldn't act so capriciously because the last thing they want is for somebody to even think about setting up another railroad. So they have to act based on market competition, even though there's only one of them. I'll have a lot more to say about this when I get to monopoly tomorrow with regard to private roads. Okay, now what I want to do is, I've done monopoly, external economies, external diseconomies. I want to do a thing called public goods. The mainstream, they love public goods. Public goods shows that the market is no good. And here is the public goods analysis. It's based on excludability and rivalrousness. And if you can, here's some notes of mine I'll just block out. If you can exclude non-payers, not perfectly, but pretty much you can exclude people who buy a hot dog and don't pay, you can exclude them. You call the cops or you threaten it. It's a very credible threat. Most people, when they buy a hot dog, they pay. So this is considered excludable. But if it's a busy city street and there are hundreds of people running around, it's very difficult to exclude non-payers, like if we privatize the sidewalks. Just think of 42nd Street and Broadway in New York City, and there's just hundreds of people walking around there continually. It's very hard to exclude, according to the neoclassicals. And therefore, it's a semi-public good because it fails the excludability problem. What's the rivalrousness problem? And for a pure public good, you have to have a no on both excludability and rivalrousness. So let me explain what is rivalrousness. Rivalrousness is, if I'm eating the hot dog, you can't eat it, so we are rivals with regard to the hot dog. On the other hand, a radio or a TV station, we're not rivals. This man over here, John, he's got a radio station, and he blasts forth the radio or the TV station, and there are 10,000 listeners, and the 10,001st person is thinking of getting in on this great show that John puts on. Is he rivalrous with regard to any of the other 10,000? No. They didn't even know that he just turned on his radio. So what they say is that if it's not rivalrous, then it's a public good, or it has public goodness. It's a semi-public good because it doesn't fit on this, and I'll explain that in a second. But the point is that it is non-rivalrous in the sense that my use of it doesn't detract from your use of it, whereas your use of my toothbrush certainly detracts from my use of my toothbrush and this pen. If I've got it, you can't have it. If you've got it, I can't have it. So we are rivals with regard to the pen, but we're not rivals with regard to TV and radio stations. What's a pure public good? The lighthouse, this is where I'm getting COAS, and also national defense. These are the two cases that Tom Woods, in his lecture the other night, was saying, what are the hardest cases to defend the marketplace on? Well, within the realm of economics in graduate school, one of the hardest ways, one of the most difficult challenges to economic freedom and private property is lighthouse of defense. And again, I'm still giving the neoclassical view on this. I haven't given the Austin criticisms, which I'll get to in a sense in a second as soon as I get to this. So the lighthouse. I put up a lighthouse, and we're now in the days before what do you call those things that boats have that they can radar or something? Sorry? Sonar power. They could find out where the reefs are or something. So we're in the 200 or 300 years ago in the 1700s or something like that. There's no sonar, no radar, no nothing, as we say in Brooklyn, except for the lighthouse. The lighthouse is on the tip of the land, and it puts on the light. And is it excludability? No, you can't. There are a whole bunch of boats out there, half of whom have paid for the lighthouse, half of whom have not paid. You can't just say, okay, you guys that didn't pay, don't look. So it fails the excludability. Is it rivalrous? No, it's not rivalrous. If another boat looks at the lighthouse, the other guys that are already looking at the lighthouse, they don't lose out. They can still see the lighthouse. So it fails both cases, and therefore it's a pure public good. And this is an example that private enterprise can't possibly do it. Or defense, and I think Bob Murphy probably did a lot on defense, so I'll just spend a minute or two on this, looking at defense from this perspective. Is defense excludable? No, because if we tell the bad guys, whoever they are, the bad guys keep changing, but there are always bad guys out there, the Russians, the Chinese, the Arabs, the Martians, who knows, there are bad guys out there, and if we tell them, look, you mess with us, we'll nuke you, we'll throw a bomb in the men's room of the Politburo, this defends payers and non-payers, right? You can't say, well, we're only doing it for the payers, that we're making this credible threat against you if you attack us. Everybody gets protected under the MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction umbrella. So it's non-excludable. And is it rivalrous? No. If we protect this young lady against the bad guys, we're protecting this young man also. They're not rivalrous. We give her more protection. We don't give him less protection. They're in the same wavelength, so to speak. So defense and the lighthouse are pure public goods. Okay, I think what I hope I've done, is if some neoclassical person heard what I just said, he would say, well, yeah, that's roughly what we say. In other words, I'm trying to be repertorial here. I wasn't criticizing yet. I was trying to give their views. And if you look at any introductory or intermediate economic textbooks and you look under public goods, I hope that what I just said is a very accurate portrayal of what they said. Because I don't want to attack a straw man, I want to attack what they believe. And this, I think, is what they believe. In any case, I've written a dozen articles on, everything, so that doesn't count for anything. And nobody, they've criticized me, but they never criticized me on the grounds that I got this far wrong. Okay, now what I'm going to do is launch into the Austrian or libertarian critique of this. The first critique is, just because the government can't exclude people doesn't mean private entrepreneurs can't exclude. Look, Lou Rockwell is excluding. Oh, I don't have my name tag. I was told not to wear it now. But you all have name tags. Those name tags are an excludability thing. I mean, if you didn't have those name tags, Barbara, the lady at the front desk, she's not going to know all of you. There are 150 of you. She hasn't memorized all of your faces yet. Some of us she knows, but others she's not going to know if you're sneaking in and getting in without paying or without permission. So this is an excludability device. This let me see if I've got my name. Yeah, here, I've got one. I'm a good guy. I've got my name tag, and if I put it on, I walk in, and even if they don't know me, they see. Like the other night, we went to the pizza place, and we were told that unless we wore this, we wouldn't get any pizza. That was a very cheap excludability. Well, you can do that for sidewalks. You can even put barcodes on the back of it so that if you walk on the sidewalk without one of these, you go beep, 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 or some light flashes on you and the cops grab you. And if it happens to one person, nobody else is going to try to do it. So just because the government can't think of a way to exclude non-payers, mainstream economists haven't thought of a way to do it, doesn't mean that entrepreneurs wouldn't think of a way to do it. And a lot of my stuff on private roads is on this, you know, excluding non-payers from the roads. But it works for the sidewalks as well. Now, how do we exclude here with radio and TV? The way we do it is John blasts his TV program out to everybody, but then he blocks it, and he rents you an unblocker that you put on the top of your TV, and you press the button, and now you can see it, and people who haven't paid it, get excluded. So it's certainly excludable. This passes, I put this in this column because you can't exclude with these jamming devices. But what about the rivalrousness? I noticed that there are empty chairs in this room. Namely, somebody could be sitting right over there and he would not be rivalrous, right? Namely, if he sat there and shut up and, you know, didn't make a fuss, he wouldn't annoy us. The point is, first of all, I should make the point that don't think that because there are four categories that you necessarily get 25% of all goods and services in each category. For the right-wing neoclassical economists, it's virtually all here. For the left-wing neoclassical economists, there's a lot more out here. I mean, there's more room for public goods. So it depends. For some people, it's a pure public good and the government's got to do everything. Or really, any of these three would be a case for the government takeover. And the left-wing economists would say that 95% of this stuff falls in these three. But with regard to this, the problem with rivalrousness as a criteria is that any time you have less than 100% capacity, there's lack of rivalrousness. I'm in a hotel, I'm in the Auburn Hotel, and let's say they've only got 95% of their rooms rented, which is pretty good. A 5% vacancy rate, I think, is pretty good. But that means that some neoclassical economist could go up to the front desk and ask for the manager and say, look, according to our neoclassical theory, you've got an empty room tonight and it's already 10 o'clock. Nobody else is going to come. Let's stipulate that no one else will come. And let's stipulate we can ignore the very minor costs of the linen change or whatever. Let me in there for free. Now, if he can say that, anyone else can say that. The first 95% of the people are sort of going to wait until 8 and say, hey, let us in for free too. How are you going to have a private a hotel? How are you going to have any hotel, ball field, theater, anything where you operate at less than full capacity? And even in the Super Bowl, there's an empty seat or two. Somebody got sick, right? Even though the Olympics that are coming up, it's not going to be 100%. There's always going to be one empty non-rivalrous space for somebody to come. And he could say, well, I want to get in for free according to the logic here. Okay, what I now want to do is to get into the lighthouse. I want to focus on the lighthouse because Coase did a lot on the lighthouse. And what Coase said was, see, the mainstream, I have to give you a little background here, the mainstream said the lighthouse is a pure public good, that's it. Coase, supposedly the free enterpriser, those Chicagoans, they really burn me up because they're not free enterprisers and yet they're known as free enterprisers by all and sundry. I mean, the New York Times, if you ask who's the free enterpriser, it's the Chicago School. And Coase is a member of the Chicago School. And he comes out and he proves that the public goods argument on the lighthouse is wrong. That's his article. And I have a little confession to make. You know, I was so bitter on Coase on the social cost thing. So when he finally came up with the lighthouse, and I knew the lighthouse was Exhibit A in the case for socialism, and Coase was reputed to have overturned it. I didn't read the whole thing. I read maybe three quarters of it. And in another article of mine, I said, well, I'm not against Coase on everything. And before I said the FDC and the free ideas thing, and I stuck in the lighthouse. I said, well, Coase is good on the lighthouse. And my colleague Bill Barnett, with whom I've co-authored 60 articles, said, block you moron, Coase is not good on this. Coase is wrong on this too. Read the rest of it. Read the last 20 pages or the last 10 pages. And Bill was right, and we wrote an article. And what we did is we listed all the people that made errors on that, including my previous article where I applauded Coase. So the lesson I get out from this is if you publish something and you make a mistake, you know, in one of the James Bond movies, Dr. No or Strange Love or some one of those movies with the guy with the white cat and he presses a button and you fall through the floor and the alligators get you? Not seen that movie? Right. I'm not making it up. It's an honest to goodness movie. Well, that's not what it's like in publishing. So if you publish, you're going to make errors. Everybody who publishes makes errors. None of us are perfect. So what you do is what I did is you say, here are the 25 people who got this wrong, and including Walter Block and his 1992 article. And the bottom of the floor didn't open up. I didn't get fired. I have tenure. That's a good thing, tenure when you have it. So don't be afraid to write and realize that's why they put the erasers on the back of pencils. We all make mistakes, and you don't die from it, and you just apologize for it publicly, and you go on. Hopefully, you'll have to do that rarely, but when you do it, I think the best way is to make an honest breast of it. Okay, so what's Coase's argument? Coase goes back to the primary sources, the minutes of the meeting of the board of whatever it was in Liverpool or London, and he says they made them pay. Namely, there were private lighthouses, and the lighthouses made them pay, made the boats pay. The problem with this is that they made all the boats pay, whether they agreed to or not. It was like a tax. Namely, Coase can't distinguish between a voluntary payment and a tax. And surely that's one of the most basic distinctions in all of political economy, the difference between a voluntary trade and compulsion. Coase didn't get it. Coase attributed a government tax on sailboats to private enterprise. And when I read that, I kicked myself for making that error, and I corrected it, and I said, look, this is not the case. Coase hasn't shown it was the case. And we spent half the first half of the article saying that Coase can't tell the difference between a voluntary payment and a tax. You can't tell the difference between a payment that you agree to and one that you're compelled to pay. If you have a sailboat, the Board of Trade or the Maritime Board of England or whatever it was, the King, I forget who it was, makes you pay. And that's not a voluntary thing. So now comes the question, could the lighthouse function in that way? And here's where Bill Barnett and I spend the second half of this article saying, look, you can make a credible threat against the non-paying sailboats. What you can say, and let everyone in town know it, and all the sailormen know it, that one of these days we're going to get you, boy. One of these days it's going to be sort of cloudy, but we can see, and maybe we can determine that there are only non-payers out there, and we're going to shut the lighthouse off, and with the lighthouse off, you're going to have a big chance of crashing. And even now, you're going to have to pay your sailors more for the risk of working for you, the non-payers, because we're not going to do that when we see payers out there. Do you get the idea? Ordinarily, most days, 364 days or 360 days, the non-payers will get a free ride. They won't pay and they'll have the advantage of the lighthouse. But one day the moon will go in, the moon will go out, and they'll see only non-payers, and they can tell the distinctive cut of the jib or the sails or something, and they'll see only non-payers, and they'll shut it off. And then some of them will crash. This ought to be a credible threat. And even on the other 360 days where the lighthouse goes on, you have to pay your sailors more because there is now hazard pay that you have to pay them because you might be subjected to this and you could lose your life if without that lighthouse. So what we say is that the lighthouse is not a pure public good. And there's nothing on this list of public goods that hasn't been provided by private enterprise. Now, the second defense of the neoclassical critiques of the market, because they're into this market failure business, the second line of defense is this, okay, it's too radical to say we won't have any national defense, it's too radical to say we won't have any lighthouses, but we'll have fewer lighthouses than optimal, right? How can you prove that? And even if you could prove that, if the private lighthouses were more productive and more efficient, that would outweigh it, even if you could prove that, which you can't. So what I've done is I've tried to take a person, Ronald Coase, who won the Nobel Prize, who's one of the chief Chicago economists of the free enterprise school, so-called, and who is got an unjustified reputation for being a free enterpriser, and try to show that at least in these two very important articles, he's really not that. And what I did last time, I took my whole hour, and when I do the roads and the ocean privatization, I'm going to take the whole hour too. So I'm purposely ending a little bit earlier now so that I can call for questions and discussion because I think you get a lot of lectures and you don't get a chance to. Tom Woods did it, but many of the lectures go the whole hour. I do because, you know, I have a lot to say about things and I want to get it all on record. So please, are there questions, objections, calls for elaboration on this subject or any subject, including chess? Yes, sir.
There were like actual voluntary contracts to build a lighthouse. Like some owners of ships kind of got there and said, hey, let's
The question is, wasn't there some citation of Coase in his Lighthouse article where there was something that looked like a private market because the boat owners got together? My reading of it is that Coase just missed the boat, pardon the pun. He interpreted as aspects of free enterprise cases where the government was compelling people to pay for the lighthouse. Now, we might have to reread it, and if you reread the Coase and you find an incompatibility with what you see Coase saying and what we see him saying, you've got a great article for a rejoinder. You can write to the same journal that published my article and say, well, Block and Barnett misconstrued this, and here's the truth. And if we see that you're right, we will capitulate. But we've read it as carefully as we could, and we didn't see that. Questions, discussion, dialogue. Yes, sir.
Well, I thought that mainly Coase insisted on the fact that transaction costs are the problem of allocating your resources to the optimal user. I didn't read that as a theory. What would the would be the consequences for an Austrian theory in terms of the transaction cost? So, like in defense, if a defense agency said, I will only defend you if you all pay for my services. What do we have to say about the fact that maybe the transaction cost allow one to achieve this?
Well, the way I interpret the question, and I've been told to repeat the question for the audience that might not have heard this, is that I'm putting it in my own words, but I hope I got the gist of it. Don't the neoclassicists have a better argument than I'm allowing them to have? At least, maybe not in the Lighthouse, but at least in national defense. Because in national defense, it's very hard to exclude non-payers. Because if half the people pay and half the people don't pay, and we protect the whole country, the other people get a free ride, and they're going to be, and the payers are going to say, it's not fair, we're paying, those guys aren't paying, let's us free ride. Everyone says, let George do it, or let the other guy do it. Okay, so let's discuss not the Lighthouse, but national defense. I say there are ways to exclude people. And it doesn't have to be perfect. Now, let's suppose in Taxachusetts, all those wimpy lefty progressives, and their sissies and all, and hardly any of them contribute to national defense, whereas in Texas, where men are men and sheep are scared, no, that's not right, where men are men, virtually all of them contribute. Well, the private defense agency can say, look, we're not going to defend Massachusetts because there's only three people in Massachusetts that are willing to pay, and they send out a message to all and sundry. Anyone goes into Massachusetts, we're not going to stop you. I got in a little trouble with my university administration. What happened is the feminists had a Take Back the Night march against rape, and I had the audacity to say that the only benefit of this is that the rapists will laugh so hard that for at least 5 minutes they won't be able to engage in rape. So silly is this, a march to stop rape, and the rapists are just laughing. And I said, we have the Olympics upcoming, and in the Olympics there are two, I think in the Winter Olympics you ski and then you shoot a rifle and then you ski some more. And in the Summer Olympics you have a pistol and you aim at the target. And I said, let's have a girls pistol shooting team. And let's announce this, and I'll bet you there'll be no more rapes at Loyola University. I mean, if I were a rapist, I wouldn't go there. I'd go somewhere else where women are helpless. The gun is the great equalizer. So what I'm trying to say about Massachusetts is if those people are really like that, and only three out of the whole state are willing to pay for it, well, those three are going to have to move out because no one will protect them, at least from the Russians. Or the far away bad guy who's going to have an ICBM. Whereas if they mess with Texas, they say, don't mess with Texas. They won't because we'll have a credible threat against them. But you can have these, these lapel pins. And everyone who pays gets to put one on their house. And if you put one on the house that you didn't pay for, that's fraud and you go to jail. And any house without this, the criminals will say, hey, one of the great signs I saw was, my neighbor believes in gun control, he's a pacifist, and I respect his view, so I'm not going to go over there with my guns and protect him, and you put it in front of your house. Well, that's going to slow down the other guy. Namely, it is excludable a little bit. Not Not perfectly, but the hot dog is not excludable perfectly. People grab hot dogs and run, right? So there are ways, we have our ways, the market has its ways of providing defense services. Most defense services now are private. Look, you go to Disney World and you act obstreperously and you're going to be surrounded by a duck here and a mouse there packing heat. And they're going to say, come with me, sir. And they've got cameras all over, so it's very, very safe. Because if something, God forbid, happened in Disney World, people wouldn't come there. Now, I live right across the street from Audubon Park in New Orleans, and if a rape or a murder occurs there, who loses money? Not the Audubon Park owner, which is the city or the parks commissioner or anything. His salary goes on invariantly with how badly. There are lots of assaults on the city streets. Very, very few in restaurants or shopping centers, because shopping centers have a private guard. So most of our defense is already private. And this idea that somehow defense is a case against the marketplace, I think, is overstressed. Anyone else before I call? Yes, sir. Free speech. Yeah, that's a very good point. Bob Murphy and Hans Hoppe have made that point. I should have included that, and I thank you for adding that. That a lot of the defense agencies will be defense-insurance agencies, so that if they fail to protect you, they'll pay you for their failure to protect you. I mean, right now you call a city cop and, you know, they twiddle their thumbs and they take their time. And then if you shoot the bad guy, they'll arrest you. You know, this case in, horrible case, I think Aurora near Denver, Colorado, where some guy takes a machine gun and starts shooting people in the movie theater. If there were another individual with a pistol and a concealed carry permit and he shot that guy, they would have put him in jail for violating the law. So what the police do is they make it impossible or very difficult for us to protect ourselves or our neighbors and our friends and our family. And then if we do that, they arrest us. And there are all these cases where, you know, somebody shoots a burglar outside their house, and unless you drag them in, you're guilty of something or other. I mean, see, even if private police were imperfect and private defense agencies were imperfect, as they will be because they're composed of human beings, you have to compare it with the alternative, which is government. One economist asks the other economist, how's your wife? And the second guy says, compare to what? Well, you always have to say, compare to what? And we're comparing with the government. Look, these are the people that bring you the post office. These are the people that bring you the Motor Vehicle Bureau. These are the people that bring you the IRS. And all of a sudden, we're going to trust them to give streets and radio and TV and lighthouses of defense and everything else. It's not an easy sell. Yes, sir, again.
Is there, to the best of your knowledge, any like historical example, or maybe not, you know, a properly, you know, run lighthouse, but even a voluntary one, regulated by the government?
The question is, was there any extant real-life example in history where there was a private lighthouse? I'm not a historian. I don't know. I haven't done research. I'm more of a theoretical economist, so I'll beg other people to help me out on that. I don't know of any cases, but there's the theoretical case. You know, one of the objections to free enterprise, capitalism, laissez-faire is, well, has it ever worked? And we have to say, well, it's never worked perfectly. There's always been a government or a hooligan or an army or a gang or something. So ours is a theoretical thing that freedom would work if it were allowed. But unfortunately, in history, it's very rarely allowed. Now, there are some cases. The early U.S., without, apart from slavery, was a pretty free place. Hong Kong, for many years before China under the British rule, was pretty close, but not perfectly close. So it's very hard to come up with examples of this. And if someone can come up with an example, that would be worth an article, I think, in many, many journals. So if you're historically minded and you can search through the historical record and come up with cases like private defense agencies where we did have them, and Joe Peden did this for Iceland or Ireland, and David Friedman did this for the other Iceland or Ireland. I think I mix up those two. So this is very important research, and I urge you people to get involved in if you're of historical mind type. Yes, sir?
That was a bit, that was one good. I listened to the corporatist model of white, private white houses that Britain had at the time was largely that allowed white houses to project far out to the ocean.
Okay, well, this gentleman is adding to our previous discussion and saying that in the 1850s they had a technological change. Again, I'm putting your words in my words. And this made the public good in this stronger, because now the lighthouse couldn't just go 300 yards or a quarter of a mile. It could now go 20 miles or something like that. I don't know the numbers, but go way further. And when you go way further, it's harder to see. My response to that is I believe that free enterprise, laissez-faire capitalism is the most efficacious and the most just in any time epoch. And I don't care about the innovations. So my reaction to this, and I take this as a critical comment, is, well, if the lights can go further, then they could see further, and maybe they could make the credible threat wider and say, look, one of these days we're going to get you guys if you don't pay. That would be my response to that. I think we have time for one half question. Come on, you guys are always surrounding me during the breaks and asking me 75,000 different questions. Here's your chance to go public. No takers. Yes, sir.
Actually, tagging on that last one, the technology increase of the lighthouse being like longer versus shorter. I had a related conversation with someone last Saturday. But you mentioned, like, he said, you know, someone's talking about the free rider problem. He said, well, you know, it's more of a free rider issue. I wouldn't call it a problem at all. He said, thank God for the free rider problem. You know, if you have a situation like that where you suddenly have a new technology and your lighthouse, your light beam is longer, you do that and more people can benefit from it without paying you, like, that's awesome, you know, for them. Like, if I, like, wear a really nice suit and, like, I spend all my money on that and you benefit from me looking great, then I don't, that doesn't mean, like, that's a problem.
Well, what this gentleman is saying is that if you can give external economies or benefits to non-payers, that should be counted as good, not bad, because Murray Rothbard makes this point. I mean, we're all free riders on civilization. I mean, we all benefit from Mozart or Elvis or whoever it is that we like. But the problem with that is, well, I think it's true, the problem with that is if we can give so many benefits to people who don't pay, then why should these guys pay? And if nobody pays, then it can't be private. So it sort of undermines the thing. I just want to make a point about innovations. People widely credit the government for the World Wide Web. And then they say during World War II, we got radar. And this shows that war is good because it creates inventions. The obvious answer to that is, well, suppose we hadn't had World War II and we hadn't had millions of very intelligent people been killed. What would we have invented in the contrary to fact conditional had there been no World War II? And probably, although you can't say for sure because it's contrary to fact conditional, we would have had radar plus a lot more, a lot quicker. So you can't say that government is responsible. A real quick question here? Yes.
I was just wondering if
absolutely. There's my man. I paid him $5 to say that. He said if the oceans were private, then we would have an end to this lighthouse case. And indeed, on my lecture tomorrow, I will be talking about privatizing roads and privatizing oceans, lakes, rivers, puddles, whatever. Thanks for your attention.